Good morning, yogis. Namaste. I hope you're all having a wonderful morning and enjoyed your morning asana. So in today's philosophy class, we're talking about the yamas. And in yesterday's module, we've looked at the eight limbs as a whole. And then now, day by day, we're working through each one of the eight limbs. So the yamas and niyamas, because there's obviously five of each, they're going to be slightly longer modules. So if you want to open your PDF, your PowerPoint, and it's downloadable as well, so you can just save that for your files. And yeah, so the yamas are basically the don'ts. So the way Patanjali described it, he's like, okay, first you have to clear yourself of certain things, certain behaviors. And then the next step for the niyamas, and then, you know, these are the things we should be doing. So the yamas are the self-restraints, you could call them, basically the don'ts, and they're the first limb of yoga. If you scroll to the second slide. So yeah, as I've mentioned, yama is often translated as the restraint or the moral discipline or a moral vow. And Patanjali made it very clear that these restraints or the yamas are universal. So it doesn't matter where you're from, what do you do, what your current situation is or where you're going. This applies to every being. We know living in the Western world, in the modern world, that, you know, to be moral sometimes can be quite difficult. This is in particular why it is so important for the practice of yoga. And if we just think about what yoga means, you know, the definition, the union with the divine or the wholeness, connectedness, signs of the mind. So we know that it's obviously important to be mindful and gentle and present in class, but a lot of times it doesn't really translate off the mat and how we can kind of use it and implement it into our day to day. So what I like to call the yamas off the mat, or the eight limbs off the mat. So in this module, and even over the next couple of days, I really want to look at how can we use the yamas and the niyamas on the mat for our own practice, but also when we teach. But how can we also try and implement, incorporate the yamas off the mat? So how can we start to think, how can we change maybe our thought system, and how can we use it off the mat? So the five yamas are ahimsa, which means non-violence or non-harm, satya, which is truthfulness or non-lying, asteya, which means non-stealing, brahmacharya, which nowadays we kind of translate it to moderation or the right use of energy, and then aparigraha, which is non-attachment. So let's look at the first yama, ahimsa. I think when we look at the yamas, it's also important to look at the order. So ahimsa being the first yama. And within the yogi community or the spiritual community, I think ahimsa is definitely one we should always be looking to. So yes, it is often the most important one. Ahimsa translates to non-violence, non-harming. Himsa meaning hurt, in Sanskrit, and a is not, so hurt not, so non-violence, non-hurting. We're talking about the non-violence in all aspects of life. So yes, when we say non-violence, obviously we're talking about the physical, but we're also talking about how are we violating, or how are we being harmful, maybe towards ourselves, towards others, and nature. And then I've mentioned, you know, thoughts and mindsets before, but oftentimes we can also be very harmful with our thoughts, especially towards ourselves. I think sometimes even more towards ourselves, because the way we speak to ourselves, to our bodies sometimes, it's quite harsh. And I like to say to my students, you know, would you speak to your friend the way you speak to yourself sometimes? And 9 times out of 10, you wouldn't, because, you know, you're trying to cheer your friends up, you're trying to motivate them, you've been very careful with your wording, you know, you want to use positive and high vibrational language. But then when we speak with ourselves sometimes, it's quite the opposite, actually. So with ahimsa, we just want to make sure that what we do and how we do it is done in harmony rather than in harm. So let's look at ahimsa on the mat. How can we practice ahimsa on the mat in our asana practice? It's, I think, one really important point is to accept where we are in our practice, and that some days, you know, our bodies just feel different than other days. And you know, you've probably experienced this. One day you'll be able to go into a full split, other days you won't. Maybe you're able to do a full split on your right leg, but you can't do it on your left leg. One way of how you can speak to your students as well is really like remind them of ahimsa in your yoga class. I like to tell my students, you know, to, especially in the beginning of a class, if it's a mixed level class, and what I often say is, you know, there are probably going to be people in the room who are more flexible than you. And then for the other side of, you know, the other half of the group, maybe they might be stronger. So let's all tap into, you know, someone else's flexibility and therefore giving your strength. And in the end, because we're all one, you know, would happen to the same energy. But also reminding them, you know, when you give different options, are you forcing yourself into a posture, or are you honoring ahimsa? Is your ego driving you to move into a, and I put like quotation marks, advanced posture? Because I think often, especially in like the current days, in the modern world, you know, we talk about, oh, it's a level 3 advanced class. And then what is advanced? Half Moon, Warrior 3, Chrome. I don't think that certain postures are more advanced than others. If someone is quite flexible, obviously they will be able to move and maybe to a split. And that could be done for even a non-yogi. You know, I've seen it in classes. If I had students who've never practiced yoga before and they came in, they did plank, chaturanga, headstand, handstand. Have they practiced yoga before? No. But they maybe, you know, worked a lot with strength. So naturally, it will be probably a lot easier for them to move into more like postures where there's a lot of strength required. And same vice versa, you know, if you have a ballet dancer or a dancer in your class, she'll easily probably be able to, you know, to move into a split or a box split. Standing splits doesn't necessarily mean only because they can do a certain posture that they are practicing yoga. One of my friends actually said she went to a hatha class before, and the advanced classes there are classed as not the postures, but the repetition. So in hatha, we usually move between like 3 to 5 times in and out of the pose, out of the posture. And it's how long you can actually remain in the posture, because, and that's what is classed as an advanced class, to still the mind whilst you're maybe in a warrior two for 10 breaths, it's a lot more challenging than maybe for someone who's quite flexible to move into standing splits. With ahimsa as well, so just to fully accept ourselves and our bodies. And this is then often when, you know, harmful talk can come in. It's like, oh, you can't do this, you know, you, why, you know, you, my body. And we're saying, it's almost like we're scolding our body. But oftentimes, you know, when there's tension, it's not just physical tension, but it's also like emotional blockages. So what we persist resists. What we resist persists. So even the more pressure you put on yourself to move and perform in a certain way, the more it will usually persist. Not pushing ourselves to the edge and causing harm. And this is what I've meant earlier. Like, do you need to actually, you know, move into a more advanced variation at this point? Or can you just feel into your body and move intuitively and see what your body needs, rather than thinking what your body or the posture should look like? So therefore, really respecting our boundaries and listening to our bodies. As a yoga teacher, if there's a lot of ego in the class, you know, students trying to like push themselves through, it really is your responsibility in a way to hold, because you're holding space. So if you notice there's a lot of like egoic energy, then it's kind of up to you to make sure to balance that energy. Remind students, you know, of ahimsa. Remind students of, it's not about, you know, what the neighbor can do. Remind them of, you know, being within themselves, and that it's their practice. It's about how it feels and not how it looks. So let's look at ahimsa off the mat. Let's look at diet in particular. And I know that, you know, a vegan or vegetarian diet may not be accessible for everyone, but maybe you can start by implementing small changes. And essentially, you know, it is totally up to you what you do. You know your body best, you know what works for your body. And I don't agree with, you know, forcing veganism or being a vegetarian on people. It's everyone's decision. What I'm doing here, I'm simply providing you with alternatives and how you can maybe start impacting your diet. Because, you know, yoga isn't just, as I've said, you know, the physical practice. Yoga is a lifestyle. What we feed our bodies, you know, how also has impact on, you know, our mind, our soul. So some of the suggestions is maybe to consider buying organic products from environmentally friendly companies. Maybe buy locally in fair trade. And when I mean as well, like environmentally friendly companies or like locally, what kind of this really depends again where you live in the world, but I'm currently in Germany and I'll try and only buy from the farmers market. I will not buy any fruit that's out of season, that's, you know, been imported from maybe Spain or New Zealand. So kind of being more conscious of where you buy. Sometimes you don't necessarily need to buy organic, because from experience, you know, I've bought organic food before, and then it's plastic wrapped. It's been imported from Australia, whereas I could buy non-organic, but it's from the farmer next door. Do you get what I'm saying here? Like, it's, you know, just weigh your options. Maybe start introducing, you know, a couple of times a week, vegetarian and vegan recipes. And there's so many, you know, humans out there on Instagram, on YouTube, that have amazing meal plans. One of the favorites that I used to like watch online, her name is, I think it's www.pickuplimes.com, and she does amazing vegan recipes, even for like meal prep. So I get a lot of inspiration from her. Something else, you know, is to maybe avoid meat and fish from discounters, because, and a lot of times with vegans, they don't eat meat because, you know, of how animals have been treated and the environment. And but let's look at this from an energetic level. And this is one of the reasons why I avoid meat from discounters. Well, I rarely eat meat anyway. But with the mass production of animals, and what we know now, that all hormones and adrenaline gets stored, you know, in the blood, in the muscle. Now, if you look at some of these animals, the way they're being kept, and, you know, they're basically lining up, they're queuing up, they know that they're going to get killed now. So the adrenaline of like anxiety, and then we eat that meat. So we eat the hormones of panic, of anxiety. If you look, and you can do lots of research on this, if you look at how anxiety and panic attacks have, you know, climbed over the years, this is really around the same time when mass production and non-free range, you know, meat kind of came into play as well. So it's just something for you to maybe have a think, or maybe even do some research. But again, if you, you know, choose to eat meat, do it, and don't feel bad about it as well. Another option would be to maybe try exchanging your, you know, your milk, your dairy milk, with oat milk or almond milk, coconut milk, rice milk or soy milk. And using plant milk makes really, really, really nice smoothies. So one of my favorite is, I usually use, so I have oat milk in my coffee. It's super, super nice. But for smoothies, I usually use either coconut or almond milk. If you take almond milk and then some peanut butter or sunflower butter with some raw cacao, and then blend it with frozen bananas. So you can just buy your bananas, and then when they almost go like brownish, you can put them in the freezer and you blend that for a smoothie. That is so nice. It's like a super delicious dessert. What else? Yeah, less plastic, you know. Maybe try carrying a water bottle with you. Bring your own tote bags when you go food shopping, and try to avoid, you know, the plastic usage. There's a lot of stores that also offer plastic-free packaging, and you can basically just bring your own Tupperware or bags, and then you can fill up the portions that you really like. And that you actually need, because often as well we buy big portions. If we live on our own, we don't really need it. So yes, okay, next slide. Ahimsa, off the mat thoughts. So what we know now is that how we perceive our reality, whether we're sick or healthy, all really comes down to our thoughts. So the thoughts play a massive role in our overall well-being. And ahimsa means being mindful of our thoughts. So when we think negative, and I've touched on this earlier, we send messages through our body that cause the fight or flight response. The fight or flight response, which is our sympathetic nervous system. You know, when we're constantly on the go. It's therefore then secreting cortisol, which is the stress hormone, into the body. And we're running on very high stress all the time then. This also means that by producing a lot of cortisol, it lowers our immune system, meaning we're more prone to illnesses and physical pains. So what we want to achieve is to kind of find our rest and digest mode, which is our parasympathetic nervous system. But it's not just about thoughts, you know, of ourselves that we also need to be mindful of. Other thoughts and feelings we could be feeling, like jealousy, judgment, anger, and resentment towards somebody else, often, yeah, it comes back to bite us because it's making us feel too when we're speaking negatively of someone else, and also looking at why we're speaking negatively of someone else, because it's usually often a projection of ourselves. So really expressing loving thoughts such as gratefulness, love, joy, and peace, they naturally raise our vibration and create dopamine in the body, and therefore also strengthens our immune system. If you want to do more reading on that, I would definitely recommend Dr. Joe Dispenza. He's a scientist and a researcher and an author. And one of the books, it's called Becoming Supernatural. He's also got a TV show on, like a series on Gaia, and it's called Rewired. And he explains everything on a very scientific, so even to the biggest skeptics, he explains he's run so many tests over the years, you know, in groups, having done like group meditations, measuring like the electromagnetic field and what actually happens to the body when we express gratitude, when we express love and positive emotions. And I've just added here a quote by Lao Tzu, and it's one of my favorite ones. Watch your thoughts, they become words. Watch your words, they become actions. Watch your actions, they become habit. Watch your habits, they become character. Watch your character, it becomes your destiny. So being mindful of that as well. How can you practice more ahimsa? So you can practice more ahimsa by using mantras or meditations. So the mantra, Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu, basically means that may all beings everywhere be happy and free, and may the thoughts, words, and actions of my own life contribute in some way to the happiness and to that freedom for all. If you have a look on Spotify, there's quite a few like artists that do really nice renditions of this mantra. But yes, it's pronounced Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu. And there's an old Buddhist meditation called Metta Meditation, and it is also translated into Loving Kindness Meditation, which ties in really nice with the mantra. So it's definitely nice, you know, once you start theming classes, it's always nice to theme it after the yamas or even after ahimsa, and you could maybe, you know, bring in the mantra, a mudra. We'll go through mantras and mudras more further down your online training, but even if you want to do meditation, the metta meditation is beautiful as well. So for your coursework, do you honor ahimsa in your asana practice? If so, can you give examples? If not, how can you try and apply ahimsa to your asana practice? And the next question is, reflect on how you speak to yourself. Are you being harmful towards yourself? And you can just pause this audio here and work through that. And then we'll move on to Satya. Satya, our second yama, meaning truthfulness. So the word sat translates to true nature, true essence. And knowing that Sanskrit is a high vibrational language, so each word is so much more than a label. It carries so many vibrations because for so many thousands of years, you know, people have been chanting the same words, the same mantras. So because of that, sad also holds the meanings of unchangeable, or that which has no distortion, or that which is beyond distinctions of time, space, and person, and reality. Many Sanskrit words use the prefix sat, such as satsang, meaning true company. So satsang, a lot of satsang means you sit together almost like a study group, and you talk about maybe the eight limbs. And then sattva, meaning pure, which leads us to understand that sat really means more than truth. It's something that is unchanged and pure. You've maybe heard sat nam before. So sat nam means I am truth, or truth I am. So satya meaning truthfulness. Satya is all about telling the truth. And not only to other people, but also and especially with yourself as well. Because if we can't be honest with ourselves, we really can't be, you know, honest in any other part of our lives, in any of our relationships. So satya is honesty. It's avoiding gossiping, using the right speech, and not deceiving. Often we identify with our irrational thoughts and emotions. And we've talked about this yesterday about the monkey mind, the citta vrittis. We looked at how, you know, we have so many thoughts and we follow one thought to the next, and it's okay to have that monkey because we need it, but it's stepping into the observer role rather than identifying with each individual thought. The emotional part of our brain evolved long before the thinking part. But the thing is, if we let our mind run away with us, we define ourselves by how we feel at that very moment, instead of seeing how things really are. So it's that identification. When we create space for ourselves, when we become less reactive, when we slow down, when we work into our parasympathetic nervous system, our rest and digest mode, we can train to be less reactive in certain situations. By being less reactive, we're then learning to see the real truth instead of acting from a place of fear and conditioning. This also means we're now tapping into our fifth dimension frequency, where we're no longer making decisions based on fear and conditioning by society or by, you know, our upbringing. The Dalai Lama, who's classed as an expert meditator, he's actually been able to slow down the response to stimuli within, you know, our primitive brain and create a fraction for more time to process situations. This then allows the more evolved part of the brain, which is also called the cerebral cortex, to actually consider before the emotional brain takes over. So your brain is being triggered by a stimuli and a thought, and then usually, depending on your experience with this, you react. Whereas the more meditation practice you get, you're able to slow down, to process these situations. And then the cerebral cortex has more time to actually consider before the emotional brain takes over. This, I hope this makes sense. If not, feel free to message me if you guys want to go through anything anyway. By realizing that we're not our thoughts, the gap between who we think we are sometimes, or our ego, and who we really are, the Atman, we talked about the Atman yesterday as well, the soul, becomes bigger, which is obviously super important. So let's look at Satya on the mat. So observing truth in our practice is by paying attention to our breath. The breath is one of the most important factors in our asana practice because it tells us when to back off. When the breath is shallow or strained, the body isn't happy. This may hurt our ego, but truth requires listening to the breath. So what I mean here is, you know, and it's very tied closely with ahimsa. When you observe your breath in the practice, you will notice whether the breath is more shallow. And that's why in the beginning of the class, it's really nice to guide students into not manipulating the breath just yet, but just seeing where the breath is. Something I like to do in, you know, literally in the beginning meditation, once you kind of ground them, get them into the space, ask them to start observing their breath. And maybe ask, you know, is your breath more shallow? You know, is your breathing more in your upper chest? Or are you breathing into your lower belly? You'll also be able to see your students the way they're breathing. So whether they're more in a sympathetic nervous system, whether they're more in their flight mode, or more in their rest and digest mode. In your own practice, pay attention to your ego mind. Sometimes thoughts like, oh, you should be able to do headstand, you should be able to do crow, you should be able to do pincher. It's really important not to should on yourself. Jolie always said that in training. She's like, don't should all over yourself. And it's so true. Should, you know, try to remove should out of your vocabulary whilst you practice or teach yoga. That's probably best. So by getting out of our ego mind, we see past our conditioned ways of thinking and uncover a more pure and beneficial way of practicing. Satya and relationships. Honesty is the foundation of any strong relationship, but letting our ego get in the way of our heart can often stop us from building meaningful relationships with others. Being truthful with others almost requires being truthful with yourself, because if you're not being honest with yourself, how can you be truthful with other people? But at the same time, you know, in relationships, you expect your friends, family, your partner to be truthful with you. But it sometimes can be the hardest thing to do, to be vulnerable and be honest. But something, let's have a look. So we've talked about compassion with ahimsa. So the Yoga Sutras advise that if being honest causes harm, to refrain from saying anything at all. So just to get you kind of thinking for a moment. Let's say if we look at ahimsa, we're not supposed to cause harm, but you know, you want to say the truth, and the truth may potentially cause harm to a person. How would you go about that? And I'll just leave that with you guys for now. A mantra to use for Satya is the Asato Ma mantra from the Upanishads, and is used by many practitioners as a daily acknowledgement of moving towards truth. Asato ma om asato ma sad gamaya tamaso ma jyoti gamaya Mrityor Ma Amratan Gamaya. And it basically means, lead me from the unreal to the real, from darkness to light, from death to immortality. And it's a beautiful mantra. It's a beautiful mantra to chant, even to chant in a group, to really raise vibration as well. You can chant mantras, you know, silently, just thinking of it or reading the words. So coursework for Satya is, how can you be more truthful with yourself? Have you ever encountered situations where you wanted to speak the truth but didn't want to cause any harm? And how can you apply Satya when you're teaching yoga? And you can pause the audio and work on this. Asteya, non-stealing. So Asteya means non-stealing, not stealing. But the question really is, why do we desire and why do we want to steal? So it's more looking at the intention behind it. When we're also talking about stealing, obviously we're talking about stealing in the literal sense, but we're also talking about, don't steal someone's time and don't steal someone's energy. So why do people steal? Do they steal out of jealousy or lack, or maybe to fill a void? The root cause for Asteya often is, I'm not good enough. And this is why Asteya is very much tied to your Muladhara, your root chakra, the feeling of not being good enough. So it is the lack of faith we have in ourselves. And therefore it creates a desire, want, and greed. We then begin to look for something to fill that void, to feel that, oh, I'm not good enough, I need to get something. Because we think everyone else has a lot more than we do. So it's almost like we're in this victimhood where we think we don't have it as good as other people. And that often, I'm not saying all the time, is the driver for stealing. So Asteya on the mat is often when you're pushing boundaries because you're competing with other yogis in the room and fear that you're not good enough. So if you look at your neighbor, you know, being in a, I don't know, one-arm handstand, and then maybe you think you need to get into a one-arm handstand as well, because if not, then you're not good enough. Stealing someone's peace in class because you're arriving late or someone else arrives late and making noise. You know, it can happen that you might be a little bit late, but if you are, you know, arrive quietly, you know, respect the sacred space. But also, how as a teacher, how will you deal with students being late, noise in the class? And often, even in the beginning, you know, the students come because they want to find relaxation beforehand. So, and they will monitor you. You're the space holder. So if you're teaching in the beginning, sit on your mat, sit in Sukhasana or lie in Shavasana, and students will mirror you. A stayer off the mat. Let's talk about consumerism. So buying more than we need in order to compensate and fill a void out of a lack mindset. How many things do you have at home in like duplicate versions? Like, do you need that fifth pair of earrings? Do you need that 10th pair of Lululemon leggings? Do you need 5 different kinds of pastas? And the list goes on and on. So you're getting the gist of what I mean. Obviously, you know, you need to buy food, you need to buy clothes. I get it, but it's more like looking at how much are we compensating, always buying more. And I think especially now, you know, around the corona time, in the beginning, where there weren't all paper, toilet paper was gone, cleaning materials was gone, taking so much that you're not even thinking about other people, that they might not have something. And it's that egoistic, you know, oh, I'll just think for myself, I'll buy more, because you know what, that fifth pair of earring, maybe someone would have really liked that pair of earring because it would have been her first pair of earrings. So I'm just trying to give you guys some little prompts to get you thinking about little bits. Stealing, Astea, being late for appointments, dates, and work. You're stealing time from others, you know. People might be early for appointments to prepare. By you arriving late, you're stealing time. And it means you then have to, you know, the class might run over, the meeting might run over. So being mindful of that. And then obviously we have the literal stealing. With Astea, we can practice abundance. And abundance is a great way of being grateful for what you already have. And the more grateful you are for what you already have, the more abundance you will attract. Because you're acting as if it's already happened, as if you're already abundant. And you therefore sending all these positive hormones to your body. So affirmations and gratitude practice is a great way to call in more abundance. Coursework. Pushing boundaries because you're competing with the other yogis in the room and fear that you're not good enough. Have you ever experienced a stay in a yoga class? If so, how did that make you feel? Or have you stole from someone's time before? Do you buy more than you need? Write down 10 things you're grateful for in your life. State it in the present tense and describe why you're grateful for them. And each sentence with writing thank you 3 times. So an example would be, I'm grateful for my family because they always support me. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And you can pause the audio now before we move on to our next yama. Brahmacharya, the right use of energy. So traditionally, brahmacharya meant chastity or celibacy. And if you remember how, you know, back in the day, yoga was only practiced by priests and by like the more like rich, the rich folk, men. And to contain their energy, they lived a celibate life to encourage yogis to conserve their sexual energy to further progress along the yogic path. In today's modern world, we can really look at the term as the right use of energy. You know, who are you having sexual relations with? Do you have changing partners? Who's the person? Do you know that person on an energy level? Because it's quite intimate. The word brahmacharya translates to behavior which leads to Brahman, and Brahman, the soul, the creator. So therefore leading us towards the divine. So Brahman, I've mentioned this in yesterday's workshop, is one of the Holy Trinity in Hindu, one of the main three deities in Hinduism, along Shiva and Vishnu. Brahmacharya is about directing our energy away from external desires and instead towards finding contentment within ourselves. Brahmacharya is about moderation, avoiding addiction, conserving your energy, and not binging. Brahmacharya on the mat. So give options for students to rest in balasana, to use their energy in the right way. If they're not able to flow through the 10th vinyasa, give them the option to rest in balasana. Maybe also give options for knees, chest, chin instead of chaturanga dandasana. Brahmacharya off the mat. And this, I've already kind of touched on this before. Who are you giving your energy to? Are you giving too much of your energy to friends? But who, sexual partners as well. Are you constantly busy? Prioritize your spare time. If you work, you go to the gym, then you practice yoga, maybe you teach yoga, then you want to, maybe go for drinks with this person, do this with that person. You have to be very careful and conscious of how you spend your time and energy. So maybe prioritize. Another question to ask is, do you feel drained after spending some time with certain people? They're so-called energy vampires. And especially if you're an empath, it's very important to protect your own energy. And the last question is, do you feel pressured to say yes and don't want to cancel plans? Because, often we think we're obligated and we don't want to cancel because we want to be that good friend, but you can't pour from an empty cup. So you have to make sure that number one, which is you, that your cup is full before you can be there for other people. So it's definitely okay to cancel and focus on yourself. It's actually called self-care time. Coursework. Are you giving too much of your time to other people and often feel depleted? Why do you find it hard to say no to people? And again, feel free to pause here and then come back. Aparigraha, non-attachment. Aparigraha often means non-attachment and non-greed. Graha means to seize, to grab, to take, and pari means on all sides. The prefix a negates the word itself, and therefore meaning non, and therefore non-attachment. Aparigraha really teaches us not to be attached to anything. And everything that is meant for us will come in divine timing. We can't control the outcome, and by becoming super attached to things, it's very forceful. It's almost like you're disturbing the natural flow. We so often become attached to the outcome and to people and to things, maybe in relationships, we're becoming attached to our partners. We've been for a job interview, we're becoming attached to the thought of we're actually going to get the job. Krishna, and we'll talk about more in your Bhagavad Gita philosophy lesson, but Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita points out to Arjuna, let your concern be with action alone and never the fruits of action. Do not let the result of action be your motive. Do not be attached to inaction. And this is really telling us that we shouldn't be concerned about the outcome of a situation, but instead only concern ourselves with what we're actually doing. And especially if you've read the Four Agreements, always give it your best. Your best will vary from day to day, depending on the state you're in, how you're feeling, whether you're sick, whether you're healthy, whether you're sleep deprived, whether you've just had, a stressful meeting. But at the end of the day, if you can say you've given it your best, then that's all you can do. And that's similar to aparigraha. If you tune something and you've did that self-inquiry and then you act on it, and then the third step is you release. So first step, self-inquiry. Second, take the action. And third step, surrender and release and just trust. So, aparigraha is all about letting go of outcomes, worrying about the future, things that haven't happened yet. Similar to the chitta vrittis, we concern ourselves. We have so many thoughts about things that have yet happened. And 99% out of the time won't even happen. But yes, we concern ourselves with them. Then we become attached. Attachments to relationships, even to materialistic, things. It sometimes it can be hard to, you know, maybe your favorite bag or your favorite pair of sunglasses. And then this is actually, I'm going to share the story. When I did my 200-hour training, I bought a new pair of sunglasses, and I was like, oh, and I never really spent a lot of money on sunglasses because I was like, you know, you lose them anyway, it's fine. And I was like, okay, I'll probably need a good set for, because obviously it's super, super sunny in Florida. And then the fourth day or so, it was Katie's birthday. It was Katie's birthday, and we had like this flamingo, and I had my sunglasses on, and like the wave, I got caught by the wave, and it literally pulled my sunnies into the water, and I was like, okay, great. And I was like, okay, apari graha. And I think that was the day I learned about apari graha as well. And I was like, okay, non-attachment, not being attached. Sometimes when you lose things, maybe someone who finds them may need them more than you do. So, yeah. Apari graha on the mat. Practice for the love of practicing and not to be better or more advanced than the yogi next to you. So I'm not saying, you know, don't challenge yourself, but practice because it's your union with the divine. It's what helps you get in, get out of your head and feel into your body. But don't try to compete, you know, even with yourself or with other yogis in the room. As a teacher, remind your students that the journey is the goal and not the destination. You know, we find so many beautiful lessons in our journey, through our journey. And often when we get to the goal, we don't even remember what the goal was because all the teachings happened along the way. Coursework 4, apari graha. Where in your life can you let go? What attachments do you have? Do you stand in your own way by being attached to outcomes? And that, my friends, were the yamas. Now, do you remember them? Ahimsa, Satya, Asteya, Brahmacharya, Apari Graha. I hope this lesson helped you. Also talking about how we can look at the yamas off the mat. All right, well, I shall hear you guys tomorrow for the niyamas, the do's. Have a beautiful day.